This Shabbat sermon is entitled From Perspective to Application and Thus to Understanding. Let me start off with a verse from Yaakov or James chapter 2 and verse 10. For a person who keeps the whole Torah yet stumbles at one point has become guilty of breaking them all. Yet you are likely more familiar with this version from King James. Same verse. For whosoever shall keep the whole law and yet offend in one point, he is guilty of all. You break one of Adonai's mitzvot, and it is comparable to breaking every one of them. This premise is a common church teaching, with the emphasis placed on grace over the law, a premise that I had shared with you last week, and one of its advocates, Matt McMillan, and his article, The Danger of Mixing the Old and New Covenants, where he surmised the impossibility of keeping all 613 mitzvot. Many theologians convey this about Torah. It is a yoke of slavery and bondage. It is a burden. It is impossible to keep all the mitzvot. I consider these perspectives to be a glass half empty position. They are rather negative towards Adonai's mitzvot. While a more enticing perspective is Yeshua's, whereby he summarizes Torah into two commandments. In Matthew chapter 22, starting in verse 36, Rabbi, he's asked, which of the mitzvot in the Torah is the most important? And his response was, you are to love Adonai your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. This is the greatest and most important mitzvah. And the second is similar to it. You are to love your neighbor as yourself. All of the Torah and the prophets are dependent on these two mitzvot. Thus, the premise embraced is, we as believers are not required to keep all 613. We are no longer under the law, but under grace. And that verse is for another day. And thus, we have been freed from the yoke of slavery, which is the law. Where this account by Matthew conveys this regarding a heavy yoke. Come to me, all of you who are struggling and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, because I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. This is construed that Yeshua is talking about Torah and its burden. Yet that premise would contradict everything else he has said about Torah. Yeshua did not come to get rid of it or replace it with something else, but he came that it may be completed. Not the mitzvot, but the promises comprised within Torah itself. Thus, we are not talking about a partial removal either, that it would be fulfilled in that our understanding would be filled correctly. Torah is required for all of these aspects. Thus, Torah must still be valid and therefore applicable. Consider Yeshua's words, and I've shared these verses from Matthew chapter 5, starting in verse 17. Don't think that I have come to abolish the Torah or the prophets. I have not come to abolish, but to complete. Yes, indeed, I tell you that until heaven and earth pass away, not so much as a yud or a stroke will pass from the Torah, not until everything that must happen has happened. So whoever disobeys the least of these mitzvot and teaches others to do so will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever obeys them and so teaches will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness is far greater than that of the Torah teachers and the Pharisees, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. So there's a lot to unpack in these verses, but I'm not going to unpack them because I'm going to focus on another aspect. This is just to provide you with a perspective with regards to Yeshua's position of Torah, the prophets, the Tanakh, basically, and that it is still foundational. How we come to understand them in relation to Yeshua, there is a transformation that has occurred in some aspects, but not in every aspect. Whereby Yeshua not only affirms it, but establishes a standard to be met. In essence, Yeshua is establishing a standard for us as believers, that the foundation is Torah, and that we're to meet a standard of righteousness that exceeds that of the Torah teachers and the Pharisees. Your righteousness is to be greater than that of the Torah teachers and the Pharisees. Yeshua did not lower the bar for his followers, but rather upped the ante, so to speak. What better way to test these common church positions than with this week's Parsha, Mishpatim? Mishpatim, Hebrew for rulings, comprises 53 of the 613 mitzvot, or roughly 11.5% of all of Adonai's mitzvot found in Torah. So this is an interesting passage, an interesting Parsha that we are looking at, and as I mentioned earlier, I'll be sending out the Living Torah portion, which will address all of it, but there's a few parts of it that I'm going to share today. So the Parsha starts with the following. Exodus chapter 21, verses 1 and 2. These are the rulings you are to present to them. Who is the them? The them is the Jewish people. Remember, they're still at Sinai. They're still receiving the covenant. And later on in this Parsha, you're going to see that the covenant is confirmed between Adonai and the people. So these are the rulings you are to present to them. If you purchase a Hebrew slave, he is to work 6 years. But in the seventh year, he is to be given his freedom without having to pay anything. Keeping in mind, this is when you purchase a Hebrew slave. How many of us in our lifetimes are likely to purchase a Hebrew slave, let alone any slave? In considering the pashat of the text, the plain and simple what it says, I would say not likely, considering slavery is outlawed in many nations, including this one. And the chances of you buying a Hebrew slave in the United States are even more remote. Thus, we are likewise not concerned with the duration of their service time. Consider that most of Shemot, or Exodus 21, pertains to this relationship between master and their indentured servant or slave. This means that the following verses do not apply to us either. In verse 3, if he came single, he is to leave single. If he was married when he came, his wife is to go with him when he leaves. But if his master gave him a wife and she bore his sons or daughters, then the wife and her children will belong to her master and he will leave by himself. Nevertheless, if the slave declares, I love my master, my wife, and my children, so I don't want to go free, then his master is to bring him before God. And there at the door or doorpost, his master is to pierce his ear with an awl, and the man will be his slave for life. So the burden and the 613 mitzvot have been lightened. Thus, the premise about keeping all 613 mitzvot is false, as I have shared with you previously, with this summation. And it's simply 7 words. Not all Torah applies to all people. We see it here in this case. If these things pertaining to the master and the indentured servant relationship, what else doesn't apply to us as believers in Messiah? That is the intent of our Living Torah study for this year. Each week you will learn more as to what applies or doesn't apply to you directly. Yet do we just throw away this entire passage of Torah pertaining to this relationship that doesn't apply directly? I would say not. There are still lessons here for us to glean. For starters, this master and indentured servant relationship and its intent can be applied to an employee-employer relationship. What is the intent Adonai is establishing with these mitzvot? Adonai is establishing a fair and equitable relationship where both parties benefit. Can this intent thus be transmitted to other relationships? So even though these mitzvot don't apply directly, there are still lessons that can be learned by them. Adonai established these mitzvot as a bill of rights for those who would be under one's authority, just as Israel was under Pharaoh's authority, yet with not the same mercy. Adonai reminds the children of Israel that you were once in bondage and the yoke of slavery was upon your necks. So do not be like your taskmaster, who was a merciless taskmaster. For in Exodus 1:11 through 14, we read, "So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built for Pharaoh the storage cities of Pithom and Ramses. But the more the Egyptians oppressed them, the more they multiplied and expanded until the Egyptians dread the people of Israel and worked them relentlessly, making their lives bitter with hard labor, digging clay, making bricks, all kinds of field work. And in all this toil, they were shown no mercy. The Sodomite sets a standard by which all who purchase a Hebrew slave are to treat the individual. Yet there is more to these verses. The slave is seen throughout Scripture. We as believers have been bought and paid for when we came to accept Yeshua's death, burial, and resurrection, thus making us his slaves. The Brit Hadashah, the New Covenant scripture writers, referred to themselves as slaves of Yeshua. Now you know that they were speaking of a specific commandment of the Torah. They loved their master Yeshua and never wished to be free of his lordship. Consider Shaul's words to the Philippians in Philippians chapter 2, starting in verse 5. Let your attitude toward one another be governed by your being in union with the Messiah Yeshua. Though he was in the form of God, he did not regard equality with God something to be possessed by force. On the contrary, he emptied himself in that he took the form of a slave by becoming like human beings are. And when he appeared as a human being, he humbled himself still more by becoming obedient even to death on the stake as a criminal. Thus Adonai emptied himself of all his power and authority in the form of Yeshua, humbling himself to experience and therefore relate directly with his creation. Shaul identifies himself as a slave to Yeshua also. Romans chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. From Shaul, a slave of Messiah Yeshua, an emissary because I was called and set apart for the good news of God. God promised this good news in advance through his prophets in the Tanakh. So Shaul, a slave and therefore a servant of Yeshua. And consider Shemot, or Exodus 21, verses 5 and 6 again, in the context of Yeshua and Shaul. Nevertheless, if the slave declares, I love my master, my wife and my children, so I don't want to go free, then the master is to bring him before God. And there at the door or doorpost, his master is to pierce his ear with an awl, and the man will be his slave for life. I would say they both loved their master, Shaul and Yeshua, because they were willing to die for him and so did. The dynamic of the slave is seen throughout Scripture. Israel is referred to as the slave of Adonai through Isaiah, basically in the third part of Isaiah chapters 41 through 66. Actually, that's only partly true. In fact, many of those passages in Isaiah are speaking of the ultimate slave, Yeshua. Sometimes when Isaiah mentions the slave, Israel, he has the nation of Israel in mind, but also is referring to Israel's greatest servant, Yeshua. However, other times when Isaiah mentions the slave, Israel, he has the Messiah in mind, who is the ultimate manifestation of Israel. We see this through Isaiah 42, 49, and ultimately Isaiah 53, known as the passage of the suffering servant. Yet the letter of the law pertaining to the master-slave relationship here isn't applicable. Now going back to Yaakov's verse, for a person who keeps the whole Torah yet stumbles at one point has become guilty of breaking them all. So let's apply further context to this verse that is so in desperate need of context. In verse 11, he goes on to say, for the one who said, don't commit adultery, also said, don't murder. Now, if you don't commit adultery, but do murder, you have become a transgressor of the Torah. So basically, verse 10 now has context that Yaakov or James is conveying that if you break one, you've in essence broken them all. Whether you've committed adultery or not, you are still a transgressor of Torah if you have murdered. And then he goes on in verse 12, keep speaking and acting like people who will be judged by a Torah which gives freedom. So this burden, this yoke of slavery, is ultimately something that conveys or brings forth freedom. Because in verse 13 he writes, for judgment will be without mercy toward one who doesn't show mercy. But mercy wins out over judgment. Notice that Yaakov references two of the more serious mitzvot, each with a death penalty attached, and not some lesser mitzvah. Yet is it really about these more serious mitzvot only? Consider what he is saying here. Let your actions be in alignment with Torah, for it is Torah that gives freedom. For Yaakov applies a perspective taught by Yeshua previously. We read in Matthew chapter 23, verse 23, woe to you hypocritical Torah teachers and Pharisees! You pay your tithes of mint, dill, and cumin, but you have neglected the weightier matters of the Torah, justice, mercy, and trust. These are the things you should have attended to without neglecting the others. So we have to focus on all without neglecting any. The more serious mitzvot must align with the weightier matters of justice, mercy, and trust. Then Yaakov heads right into one of the weightier matters that contradicts the false premise of the mitzvot not being of importance to the believer. In verse 14, he conveys, what good is it, my brothers, if someone claims to have faith but has no actions to prove it? Is such faith able to save him? Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes or daily food, and someone says to him, shalom, keep warm and eat hearty, without giving him what he needs. What good does it do? Thus, faith by itself, unaccompanied by actions, is dead. Quoted another way, faith without works is dead. Interestingly, this week's Parsha addresses verse 15, whereby Adonai makes provisions for the poor. Again, verse 15, suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food. For in Exodus chapter 22, starting in verse 24, if you loan money to one of the people who is poor, you are not to deal with him as would a creditor, and you are not to charge him interest. If you take your neighbor's coat as collateral, you are to restore it to him by sundown. Provision of clothing. Because it is his only garment, he needs it to wrap his body. What else does he have in which to sleep? Moreover, if he cries out to me, I will listen because I am compassionate. So this is the first aspect that Yaakov is addressing in his response with regards to the application of both faith and keeping the mitzvot. The second aspect is found in Exodus 23, 10 and 11. For 6 years you are to sow your land with seed and gather in its harvest. But in the seventh year you are to let it rest and lie fallow, so that the poor among your people can eat, and what they leave the wild animals in the countryside can eat. Do the same with your vineyard and olive grove. So here is the weightier matters of justice and mercy being expressed in Torah that in essence Yeshua has conveyed are just as important as any of the mitzvot, and in essence Yaakov is addressing in this passage as well. So Yaakov continues with his application of Torah and its relation to faith. There must be a balance. For in verse 18 he continues, but someone will say that you have faith and I have actions. Show me this faith of yours without the actions, and I will show you my faith by my actions. You believe that God is one. Good for you, he says. The demons believe it too. The thought makes them shudder with fear. But, foolish fellow, Do you want to be shown that such faith apart from actions is barren? Wasn't Abraham Avinu, Abraham our father, declared righteous because of actions when he offered up his son Yitzhak on the altar? You see that his faith worked with his actions. By the actions, the faith was made complete. And the passage of the Tanakh was fulfilled, which says, Abraham had faith in God, and it was credited to his account as righteousness. He was even called God's friend. You see that a person, Yaakov continues in verse 24, you see a person is declared righteous because of actions and not because of faith alone. Likewise, wasn't Rahab, the prostitute, also declared righteous because of actions when she welcomed the messenger and sent them out by another route? Indeed, just as the body without a spirit is dead, so too faith without actions is dead. Thus the premise of Torah being a burden, a yoke, past tense, all are contrary to the words and actions of Yeshua and his Talmidim. So the challenge for us today is knowing what applies specifically, what applies indirectly, and what does not apply at all, whether it be related to gender, occupation, or purpose. The one thing that is certain is what Shaul conveys to Timothy. And I'm closing with these verses, that all scripture is God-breathed and is valuable for teaching the truth, convicting of sin, correcting faults, and training in right living. Thus anyone who belongs to God may be fully equipped for every good work. So here you have just a snapshot of the application of some of the verses from today's Parsha Mishpatim and how they apply but not apply directly. So these are things that we're going to be learning over the weeks and months to come as we continue our journey through this year's Parsha cycle, that we learn how to truly live by Torah in terms of what applies to us, what doesn't apply to us, what we can learn from things that don't apply to us, but knowing that every word in Scripture is profitable, is required for truth, convicting of sin, correcting of faults, and training in right living.